Edition of Soundography. I'm Brian Ibbett.
And I am Hammond Chamberlain.
And we come to you every week with a crash course in popular music, one band at a time. And we're going to go back to the early 90s for this one. Well, at least the beginning of this band takes place in the early 90s. A band that I guess took their original name from a basketball player. I'm talking about Pearl Jam.
I think that most people will be familiar with the first three albums.
I think so too, right? 10, of course. Verses and Vitalogy, which were all great, you know, really, really good albums, really solid albums.
And it's funny. I think they really spanned, even though I think they resisted the idea, they really did span a multitude of musical tastes. They got played on popular radio. They got played on hard rock radio. They really did kind of universally feed into the zeitgeist of the time.
Mm-hmm. They did. I mean, obviously, you know, we have to begin with talking about grunge.
Yeah.
And how it was like these guys, and of course Nirvana and Soundgarden all coming out of the early 90s Seattle scene, just at a time when pop music and stuff that was getting played on the radio was getting so
monotonous,
homogenic. Yeah. Like where it's basically you're hearing exactly the same thing with a different drum machine and a different, bass guitar and things like that. And grunge was kind of the breath of fresh air, the garage rock fresh air that we needed.
Yeah. We had a ton of like hair metal taking over on one side of the coin, and on the other side of the coin was this samey kind of pop noise that was going on.
Right.
And then grunge came in and kind of blew the whole thing up. You mentioned the three main bands. I kind of think that
Stone Temple Pilots.
Well, yeah. Well, I was thinking that you could go Alice in Chains, Soundgarden, Pearl Jam, and Nirvana would be the big four for grunge.
Yes. I forgot about Alice in Chains. Yeah.
Just like Slayer, Megadeth, Metallica, and Anthrax were the big four for thrash.
Is that like the holy quad, you can't say Trinity. So the holy quadrinity or whatever.
I think to have a movement, you have to have four people with their finger. I mean, enough people with their fingers in it, maybe not four, right. But there has to be enough of a variety within that movement so it can kind of catch on with a number of different people in a number of different ways.
Right. Right. No, I would agree with that. Band was originally, going to be called, Mookie Blaylock.
Yeah.
After the basketball player and settled on 10. Now, was Eddie part of the band when they were talking about Mookie Blaylock, or was that after? So it was Mother Love Bone, kind of rising from the ashes of Mother Love Bone, because it was Stone Gossard and Jeff Ament from Mother Love Bone. The lead singer died from an overdose. Uh-huh. And then they decided, all right, we're folding that band. We're going to start up a new one. We got Eddie Vedder, who's like a San Diego surfer with a great voice and long wavy hair, and then Mike McCready. Is that the point at which they changed their names, or was it?
I think so. I'm not when they actually changed is not super certain to me, but I know they changed, and then they pulled 10, the album title, from Mookie's jersey number.
Right, right, yes. Great piece of trivia, too.
And who knew that they were such basketball fans?
Right, yeah.
I mean, you look at them, you don't see them as, you know, seat side for the Keystone Arena.
Let's go record some grunge, and then we're going to go check out, we got...
The Supersonics and the Lakers.
Right, we got floor tickets for the at the Staples Center. Perfect, great.
I love the fact that Eddie's audition was the background singing for Hunger Strike.
Oh, really? With Temple of the Dog? I didn't know that.
Yeah, they pretty much called him up and said, hey, sing some backgrounds on this. And they really liked what he did. And that was kind of his audition.
I thought he did. Didn't he do main vocals for Hunger Strike?
No, I think that was a
sound. I don't mind stealing bread.
I think that was Soundgarden.
And you could totally be right.
Chris Cornell.
Chris Cornell's doing main vocals. Okay.
Chris Cornell, right. Mike McCready, Stone Gossard, Jeff Ament, Matt Cameron on drums, and Eddie Vedder doing background vocals.
Wow. Okay. That's crazy. Because I didn't hear about Temple of the Dog until after Pearl Jam became a thing. And so it always felt to me like it was this super group that was formed after all of these bands started out and said, all right, let's do something together. But this was actually before Pearl Jam was Pearl Jam, really.
Yeah, and I love the fact that was an audition, and I love the fact that supergroup was formed after or before they were groups and before they were super. And then I also think the reason I didn't hear Hunger Strike until after 10 had come out, and I really do think it was because that all of a sudden they realized, oh, we have members of Soundgarden, right, and we have members of Pearl Jam all on this thing. Now the record label can make this a push, and this basically one-hit wonder group can get out there.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I think that was the case. I think we never would have heard about Temple of the Dog had it not been for the later popularity of Pearl Jam. I think you're and Soundgarden. I think you're totally right on that.
Yeah, I think it was one of those things where, like, hey, look, this actually is something that kind of worked out for us. Let's give it a big push.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden it's on radio.
Wow.
Because I'm pretty sure I didn't hear it until, let's see, I was already working Graveyards when that came out. So that was 94. So it was well after 10 when I kind of became aware of it and started hearing it more often.
Interesting. Now, that was the tie-in with that and singles, right? The movie, because I remember seeing Eddie Vedder again really, really early on in Pearl Jam's
career
tenure, right? Exactly.
They were in the band Citizen Dick,
which is Matt Dillon's backup band. From that movie, which is hilarious.
And oddly enough, the song that I remember most from singles is Wood by Alice in Chains.
Mm-hmm.
That's
right.
That's the song that kind of pulled me into singles. And that's a song that's still on my phone to this day that is related to that soundtrack. For me, it was
Drowned by Smashing Pumpkins.
Yes, that was also a really good one too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was such a great soundtrack. And again, you know, 1992 film.
Talk about defining an era.
Right. Basically, it's the Fast Times at Ridgemont High for the early 90s.
It really is.
But that soundtrack was like everybody's primer into grunge music. I mean, you had Alice in Chains, you had Pearl Jam, you had Soundgarden you had Chris Cornell solo, but Soundgarden. You had, other Seattle music, you had the Heart Sisters and Nancy Wilson as the Lovemongers doing a great Led Zeppelin cover back then.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Oh, gosh. I can hear it. I can't think of the name of it.
Battle of Evermore.
That's it, yeah.
They're one of Zeppelin's tributes to Tolkien, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You have Mother Love Bone on there. You've got the aforementioned Smashing Pumpkins song. You got Screaming Trees. There's a band that I remember from the 90s and not much else.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And of course, Paul Westerberg, who he had to be some sort of music supervisor for the album too, because it was so
odd to have him there.
I don't know. It was odd to have him there. He's great, but it, he's kind of out of place among all of these grunge artists. Cause I mean, he was the Replacements basically. He was the lead singer of the Replacements, and I wouldn't call them a grunge band, of course, preceded the whole grunge movement, maybe garage rock, but and he's not like a Seattle mainstay.
No.
Interesting.
The one thing I can say again, since we're talking about soundtracks and the grunge era, if you can get to the movie Hype by Douglas Prey, it's a documentary about the rise and fall of grunge, and get the soundtrack for that. there's some great music on there. There's the Posies. There's, you know, early Nirvana. They show in the film.
Oh, wow.
It's an awesome, awesome documentary.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm looking at it now. I got to look at the soundtrack here because that's what I'm curious about. Oh, Flop, The Gits, Super Suckers. Yeah, right. Holy cow. Yeah, this sounds like it again, right up my alley. I'm going to have to check this out. Surviving the Northwest Rock Explosion.
Yeah. Huh. So, cool.
I've never heard of Hive.
Such a good movie.
Cool.
So I think that just to kind of back up, we probably need bring up the fact that they formed in 1990. They've sold 60 million records worldwide, which is pales in comparison to, you know, last week's episode of Duran Duran. But when you think about how they started out basically as a niche band in a niche genre, to have the staying power and impact on a sound and other musicians that they've had is pretty impressive.
It totally is. Because they're still, you know, I mean, Nirvana's no longer together for obvious reasons, and Dave Grohl and Foo Fighters are absolutely amazing. But when you look at bands that came out of that era, you still see the occasional Chris Cornell thing, right? He's doing a lot of solo stuff. But Pearl Jam, I mean, they're still releasing albums. They released an album just a few years ago, Lightning Bolt. And they're not officially broken up. I know Eddie Vedder is doing so many solo things since then, or has done so many solo things.
I don't know if they've actually said where they're done or if they're just on an extended hiatus.
On a break. I think it's just on a break. I remember hearing that they haven't officially called anything quits. So we could see another Pearl Jam album in, you know,
and then not
in 2016,
distant, 2017. Yeah, I mean, there's always, I think, even if they might be even quote unquote broken up, I don't think they've closed the door on that to the point where they couldn't come back and say, hey, it's, you know, 2021. It's the anniversary of 10. Let's go do something amazing.
Right. Right. Totally. All right. So I'm sorry. I keep veering us off track here.
No, that's fine. One of the things that I find truly interesting about Pearl Jam and particularly Eddie Vedder is the fact that they seem very uncomfortable with success. Mm-hmm. It's something that has kind of been added to the mystique of Pearl Jam, but it's also kind of dogged them. I mean, they didn't make a ton of videos when they first came out, and when the ones they did, they seemed to make kind of grudgingly and kind of half-assed because they just weren't buying into it.
Forced to by the label, basically. Yeah.
And it seems as if that they care about the fans and they want to be successful, but at the same time, that hot, bright, hot spotlight is something they've all seemed to shrink away from and hide from over the course of their entire career. Mm-hmm. And as far as fan service goes, you can't get a band who is more in tune with their fans. They were releasing live recordings of every one of their live shows for a while.
Right. I remember seeing the album covers, basically these brown paper bag, basically album covers. And it was just the city and the date. And you could get all that stuff. It was like almost like a Grateful Dead kind of thing where you've got, you know, oh, in this concert, they did this set, or in this other show, they did this set. It's so cool.
They recorded every show between 2000 and 2001 and released 72 live albums.
Wow.
And at one point, well, at two points in that time, they set the record for having most albums debut in the top 200 at the same time.
Huh.
So they had, or they not debuted, most, they set the record for having the most albums in the top 200 at the same time because of that.
Really?
That thing. Yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah. Cause they, they'd have like 15 live albums. How many, what was the total that they had?
72. Up
that's crazy.
So that's amazing that, I mean, that shows you, one, their fan base is super interested in what they're doing. But it also showed that they were actually eliminating and killing that live show recording market by just doing it themselves.
Right.
And other bands have done it. Dave Matthews allowed recording, and I don't know if they were doing it officially, but they allowed recordings. Blues Traveler's always allowed recordings. Metallica is now selling recordings of their shows on their website for way discounted prices, and some of them are free. It's interesting how this is a trend now that bands are doing because they know their fans want to hear more than just the studio stuff and sometimes can't get to live concerts.
And I think even since then, since they did this, you know, back in 2000, 2001-ish, people have gone so far as to sell the live recording of a concert at the concert itself. So at the end of the show, you can stick around and get like a CD or a thumb drive or something. I'm trying to remember who did this, but it was, I remember it being so pioneering that, did you enjoy the show? You can actually get it on a thumb drive on your way out. Recorded right from the
soundboard. Right
from the soundboard, yeah.
I love that kind of stuff. I wish more bands did it. I love the fact that bands are thinking about extracurricular stuff for their fans. Dream Theater's done it and released their whole bootleg series. It's awesome.
Well, it goes to the whole thing where bands say that albums make the label money, but touring and concerts make the band money.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so anything they can do to kind of help, you know, help get some of that, but the stuff that they work so hard to do, right? You know, yeah. without the band, you know, the label's obviously not going to make anything. So, I mean, the band should be getting the lion's share of it. And if they can get that by doing innovative things with their concert recordings, then by all means, they should. Now, this came after, and speaking of kind of touring and concerts, this came after the stuff in the middle of the 90s with them and Ticketmaster, right? Because it was the whole like Ticketmaster surcharge this and extra tack on fee that and everything that they just said, no, enough of that.
Yeah. I think bands that have causes that actually try to help the fans and try to help, you know, make the experience better, cheaper. Mm-hmm. I admire that. I don't know how I feel about other causes that bands have taken up, Metallica. Mm-hmm. But it also affected Pearl Jam pretty adversely. They were forced to play smaller venues, and they were forced to not have as much ticket revenue, and their touring schedules were different because of the places they had to play. So it was a sacrifice on them, too.
Has it had any effect on, in the long run, on Ticketmaster? Like, because of this, has Ticketmaster adjusted? To my knowledge, no, right?
I mean, I don't think so.
I still feel like I get gouged every time I have to buy concert tickets with Ticketmaster.
Like I said, I think Smith Ticks here in town, I think they made some minor adjustments, but I don't think it was anything. I think it was more lip service than anything else. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's what Ticketmaster did too, was just kind of some lip service.
Maybe. Interesting.
Let's see. So the discography, 1991 is 10, which came on the scene like a giant tornado, and it took over. I think everybody I knew at the time get through everything else they were listening to away and started listening to 10, Nevermind, Jar of Flies, you know, Dirt. I mean, that was everything people were listening to.
Right. Right. Oh yeah. Even Flow is constantly, on the radio. Jeremy.
MTV Standard.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then things started to shake out a little bit, and we started seeing what their sophomore efforts were going to be like. And a lot of these bands' sophomore efforts were not what their debut efforts were. But Versus was a very strong sophomore effort and actually continued a rise and kind of a permutation through the popular consciousness of music, which was pretty good for a sophomore album, because sophomore albums can be pretty hit or miss. And the fact that they came out as strong as they did was good. It's a testament to their talent.
Yeah, for sure. Daughter came from that. Elderly Woman Behind the Counter in a Small Town came from that. A great one to Google.
My favorite thing that came out of Daughter is our local radio station here in town did a parody of it called Don't Call Me Homer. And I like I said earlier, I spent way too much time trying to find it. So because I wanted to play it, but I couldn't find it. But if anyone can.
God, I'd love to hear that. I think it sounds, just from the description of it, it sounds like it's going to be hilarious.
I mean,
right?
Just the idea of the rhythm. You when I mentioned it to you before we started recording, you had the rhythm of it down. And thinking of it makes me laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Then 1994, 94, Vitalogy, yes. Another great album, and for a pretty fast turnaround too. I mean, 91 to 93 is time to write and tour and kind of develop material. For them to turn around a year later, which means they were recording it less than a year later and got Vitalogy out in 94, says an awful lot about what they had in, I guess, written in the bank, kind of.
You always wonder too, like when they come out with the, you know, the first album is going to be kind of the handpicked singles that the label helps kind of choose to say, all right, these are going to be the things that represent the band. And you wonder how many of these songs are previously written or just kind of unfleshed out ideas that they save for the second album and the third album. Because those first three albums are just brilliant. You know, there's not a stinker in the bunch.
Yeah. And even for me, who likes the heavier stuff on their spectrum, I can listen to it straight through and not have, feel like I have to skip certain things in those first three albums. Those are, those are three, if you're going to put a trifecta of albums together, I feel as if the three that they came out with first are some of the stronger ones.
For sure. Yeah. Great, great triple debut there. Vitalogy had Better Man. It's probably the biggest one. I remember Spin the Black Circle being kind of the early cut, the one you heard before the album got released. Last Exit. Let's see here. Corduroy, Nothing Man. Yeah, this is it's another really, really good album.
Did they do a Unplugged MTV? Or was that not them?
I know Nirvana. I know Nirvana did. Oh, yeah, they did. 1992, they did an entire Pearl Jam. Oh, it's funny. They didn't release, MTV didn't release it until 2009.
Really?
Yeah. It was recorded in 1992, but not released as an album until 2009, which is crazy.
That seems, I wonder why.
They included a lot of it on the, when they re-released 10 or the reissue of 10, it included a DVD of the performance. So that was a way that people could get it.
That's still shocking to me that MTV didn't release that until 2009. It seems like they really missed the boat on that one.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, to release that right around the time of Vitalogy would have been brilliant. Pearl Jam was still pulling in tremendous sales numbers, and it would have been a huge coup for MTV to release that. I don't know why they waited so long until basically like the backspacer time frame, 2009.
Yeah, you would have think. Yeah, okay. Well, all right. Then we have Merkin Ball, which was an EP in 1995. Mm-hmm. Then No Code in 1996. Yield in 98. And you have my favorite piece of trivia about Yield.
Yes, that you can actually still go to Amazon.com and buy a copy of Yield on mini disc. Like, if you still have a mini disc player, which Hammond and I both discovered that we both still have mini disc players. I actually have multiple. I'm sure, I don't know if you do or not, but I've got.
I used to. I just recently got rid of all but the portable that I had.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I've got, I think, two decks and then two portables. I don't know why. I don't know why I'm holding on to all of it. I know it's not, it's certainly not ever, because that's going to come back, because, you know, it's smaller than a cassette and it lets you do the jumping right to music. But keep in mind, mini discs were before we had commercially affordable, burnable CDs.
In fact, that was the reason why I jumped full on to it, because it was a digital quality, skippable, like customizable CD.
Yeah,
that I could do, and I had a mini disc player in my car with a six disc changer underneath the seat.
Oh, see, that one I didn't have. I had the I just had a single, but holy cow!
Yeah. The best part about that was we drove to Vegas just after we got married, and we put three of her discs into the six disc changer, and I put three of mine. Mm-hmm. Hers were like discs that I recorded, like Toby Keith and Clint Black and, I don't know, somebody else. Just, you know, pop country kind of stuff. And mine were like Spock's Beard, Dream Theater, and Transatlantic. So we get on the highway. She hears one of her songs. We get in. The next song starts, and it happens to be Change of Seasons by Dream Theater. Mm-hmm. We're 30 minutes out, and she goes, "Wait a minute, you're cheating."
Well, and I go, no kidding.
So the next song is Spock's Beard. It happened to be one that runs 33 minutes long. And she's like, okay, you're done. And to this day, I still can't pick music when we go on road trips.
That's hilarious. Oh my gosh. Picking the, all right, you get a song and then I get a song. Perfect. Oh man. That's fantastic.
But, back on, see, now it's my turn to pull us off track.
Yeah, there we go. Yep.
So
we're talking about no code. Sorry, we're talking about yield and yield available on Minidisc.
Then they released Live on Two Legs, which was, I guess, officially their first live release. Mm-hmm. And then they did a cover of Last Kiss from the 1998 fan club CD.
Right.
Which I didn't realize they did the fan club CDs until I was doing this homework.
Well, and it was originally recorded for a Kosovo tribute. A charity album, 1999 charity album called No Boundaries. And then it got included on the fan stuff.
Okay. And then in 2000, they did Binaural. And I had to look up what that is. And according to the internet, it is a method of recording that uses two microphones arranged with the intent of creating kind of a 3D stereo sound sensation for the listener.
Gotcha.
Which makes some sense because everywhere I looked talked about how this particular album was very much experimental for them and how they were doing things they typically weren't doing, songwriting and musically, trying new techniques and kind of getting out of their comfort zone. Hmm. And with this technique, I can see how and why it kind of inspired them to do different things.
It doesn't surprise me because Eddie Vedder does seem like he likes to push the boundaries and try different things. He released an entire solo album of ukulele covers, for example.
I had no idea he did that.
Oh,
that now makes him my favorite person on the planet.
And it is fantastic. It is really, really good. And then he's done stuff with Neil Finn. He did the Seven Worlds Collide and does a lot of stuff back and forth with Neil Finn. Split Ends covers.
They worked with Neil Young.
And
backed
right.
him up on his album Mirrorball. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, I mean, it doesn't surprise me that they would try this. It's kind of like the Pink Floyd, hey, you know, let's see what this is all about. Let's try this out and let me do this. And I'm going to branch off and do an entire show tunes album. And, you know, it kind of shows you, it's funny because this is something that you see other artists do, where they try and break the mold every time and try and reinvent themselves. Pearl Jam does it in such a subtle way.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I was going to say, I mean, they do it in such a subtle way where, you know, it's not like, hey, for our next album, we're going to record it completely wearing animal costumes.
Okay. So they might be subtle, but the ukulele covers is not subtle.
Well, no.
I can see, but you're right. They seem to fight recording stagnation. Mm-hmm. I have my opinions about musical stagnation, but I feel like they do try to make the recording experiences different every time, and they try to challenge themselves there.
Right.
But I'm not sure about everything else. We'll get to that. So you mentioned the musicals, which brings me to another one of my favorite parody pieces ever.
Okay.
There's a comedian named David Crow, and there's a bit that he did on the Bob and Tom morning radio program where he does an impression of Eddie Vedder doing songs from Sound of Music.
A female deer, Ray, a man who owns a gun. Me a name, I call myself for the first sound in Fight Ticketmaster. Needle in my vein, law in order to restrain. Team World Head is nothing but a letter.
And I will throw it in. I will put a segment of it in here because it is awesome.
It's spot on. Yeah.
But if nothing else, go look up David Crow. He does more in his, you know, like on his live discs. And if you can find it, great. Support David Crow. But his little bit about Eddie Vedder is perfect and totally makes things, my life, happier.
Cool. I remember Adam Sandler also doing a pretty good Eddie Vedder on Saturday Night Live. I don't remember what the context was, if it was a skit where they were where he was basically impersonating Eddie Vedder, or if it, for some reason, I'm thinking it came up during a news segment, but I feel like he was always doing Opera Man.
Yes.
During
the chopping during broccoli this. And Opera Man.
Right. Oh, no. Chopping broccoli was Carvey.
Oh, that's right. It was Carvey.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
But there was something else. You're right, though. There was something else besides Opera Man. He would just come on and do the music, right? Yeah, like he would do the Hanukkah song and stuff like that. Yeah. There was more to.
Yeah. Oh, and back to Yield for a second. I forgot sure. this. Todd McFarlane actually animated one of their videos for Yield.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Todd McFarlane did a lot of that. He did Korn. He did Disturbed.
I remember the Korn video. Yeah. God, that was such a great video.
He did Land of Confusion for Disturbed. And he did Do the Evolution from Yield, which when you think of Todd McFarlane's style, there's a definite Todd McFarlane fingerprint on it. And
yeah, for sure.
And it definitely has evokes certain thoughts and emotions when you watch things he did and when you mix them with music. I mean, even like when he did the Spawn animated series on HBO, there was a definite vibe to it that he seems to carry. So that's an interesting thing.
I think if the heavy metal animated films were still coming out today, I think we'd see a Todd McFarlane segment in there for sure.
Most definitely. Yes, very much so. Mm-hmm. And who's the guy who does the kind of the wiggly animation and the faces alter and mutate?
Oh.
You know who I'm talking about, right?
Yes, Plimpton.
Yes, yes.
Bill Plimpton.
Yeah, he could do one too, to be unsettling.
I'd pay $100 to see that right now. That would be so good.
Just unsettling and off-putting. That's all it needs to be.
How do we kickstart this, Hammond? How do we make this happen?
Oh, my gosh.
Okay. All right. So Yield and Binaural. Binaural.
Then they did Riot Act in 2002. Mm-hmm. And then in 2006, they came out with their self-titled CD.
Their eponymous. Right,
yes, exactly. After almost 2 decades, they decided to roll out with their, two decades, they rolled out with their self-titled album.
Well, now keep in mind, we just did Duran Duran last week. And even though their first album was called Duran Duran, even though their first album was called Duran Duran, they did the same thing where, you know, again, it was like, 20 years after they started, they came out with, let's call this next one Duran Duran.
Yeah. Well, Metallica did the same thing. They came out with Metallica after 4 albums, and Dream Theater just did it recently, and Spock's Beard did it. Everyone does. No one's doing it as their debut album anymore. I guess that's not the in vogue methodology anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then there was Backspacer in 2009, Lightning Bolt in 2013. And then they had their, they released Rearview Mirror, their 91 to 2003 Greatest Hits album. Mm. And as far as Greatest Hits albums go, I have to admit, they kind of nailed this one.
Yeah, it's really good. And it was when we were coming up, at least when I was coming up with my list, I was trying not to pick stuff from Rearview Mirror because it is such an all-encompassing, you know, if you're going to do a playlist, that's 90% of it is going to be right there on Rearview Mirror.
Yeah. I think if you put in 10 and Rearview Mirror, you kind of cover Pearl Jam.
Right.
And so the challenge for us was to dig beyond Rearview Mirror and to dig beyond 10 and to find the other things that might not be as familiar to people, which is kind of the whole challenge of the show for us and for the listeners.
It totally is. Yeah. Now where, the re-release of 10, was where in this, was that 2011? I want to say it was like at an anniversary of,
I think it was 11 because it was definitely in a post iPhone era. Cause I have it on like iTunes.
Yeah. And I want to say it was recent enough that I'm trying to look it up really quick and I'm not saying it. Oh, I know what it'll be. It'll be on the page called 10. Duh. Well, you know, I was thinking, oh, well, it won't be on that one because that was the original release. But here it is. The re-release was 2009. Oh, so So recent, but not as recent as I thought it was.
So same year as Backspacer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So is that label worried that Backspacer wasn't going to sell enough?
Or? Oh, maybe, right?
Because I'm sure that over the course of their latter half of their career, their numbers are not what they had been. And I bet mm-hmm. you it's decreasing with every subsequent album.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I remember there were, yeah, here it is right here. So there were four different versions of the 10 re-release that you could buy. The Legacy Edition, the Deluxe Edition, the Vinyl Edition, and the Super Deluxe Edition.
Wow.
It's like James Cameron films.
And I bet you they were probably 19, 50, 75, and $250 each.
Right. I think so, because they all had increasing amounts of music on them. One of them was just a remastering of the first of the album. Then the next one added another album of remixed tracks, and then a third one included all their MTV Unplugged stuff, and then a fourth album had a live album, a live version as well, or a live a live album as well. So
they seem to be the Murphy Brown of bands when it comes to drummers.
The Spinal Tap of
yeah, well,
of real bands.
Yeah. And it's funny, they go through them like Kleenex.
Right.
And I cannot remember how many of them they went through, but they've been through enough that I made note of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tim Burton worked with them and asked them to do a song for the movie Big Fish.
Oh, really?
A Man of the Hour was written for the film Big Fish.
Oh, that's totally cool. I'm gonna have to dig up the soundtrack and listen to that, because that's one I didn't find in my travels through their library. I knew that Eddie Vedder had worked on the song was A Big Hard Sun, I think is what it's called, and it was for I think he was actually involved with the whole soundtrack. Into the Wild was the movie.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Just from a few years ago. And I want to say that Eddie Vedder was involved with more than just that lead, just that song. I think he did the entire score and soundtrack as well.
Okay. Well, let's do the Stairway to Heaven song.
Okay.
Before mm-hmm. we start talking about our thoughts, and then we can move into our playlists.
Sure.
What is your thought on the Stairway to Heaven song?
I think Alive, if they don't do the song Alive, which, again, came from that landmark album 10, if they don't do that in concert, I think people are walking out. I think they're dumping their popcorn on the floor, ripping up their non-Ticketmaster ticket and walking out.
See, and I'm torn between all three that you, mm-hmm. Alive, when you added Alive, that added a wrinkle that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah.
Jeremy and Even Flow.
Right. I saw those before I wrote mine. I'm like, oh yeah, those are really good choices.
So I think we might have a three-way tie, because if you look at Jeremy, that's the one that blew them into public consciousness.
Yes.
So that's the one that everyone
was their mainstream hit.
That's the video. That's everything. Even Flow and Alive are those songs that are just too good not to hear.
Yeah. I think if we had to narrow it down to one, Jeremy is the obvious choice.
The fact that money didn't care came down on me. probably would have to do that just because of the impact it had on them as a band and us as an audience.
Yep.
So the Stairway to Heaven song would be Jeremy.
There you go.
All right. Oh, I wanted to bring up, this is the second week in a row that we've had a documentary or a concert film directed by a famous director.
Yeah, no kidding. And this is another one that I hadn't heard of. I didn't hear about, by the way, I watched that David Lynch thing.
Uh-huh.
It is the weirdest damn concert video I've ever seen. It's almost all in black and white. And there's, it feels like he decided not to edit anything out. So there's, you know, some time where it's like, all right, let's get so-and-so up on stage. And there's banter that's not like typical concert banter. And then there's this like, overlay of somebody banging a barbecue with hot dogs flying all over the place during the entire song, one of the songs on there.
Oh, was it, they're like, was it Wild Boys?
No. Oh, you know what might have been? Somebody hitting, that would be really funny, right? But it's somebody hitting a barbecue grill with a spatula. No, I think it's Come Undone.
Oh, really?
And somebody's hitting a barbecue grill with a spatula for the entire song. And it's not like repeated footage, because you see these hot dogs bouncing all over the place and they never return to their original location.
So it's not a GIF.
It's really, it's, you know, when we were talking about the log lady making an appearance, I don't think we were that far off.
Oh my gosh.
From something that could have really happened.
So Cameron Crowe did this documentary about Making of Yield, which, okay, by the way, is still available on Minidisc for those of you who are interested. And it's called Pearl Jam 20. And today I was actually at my local record store beefing up on stuff for upcoming shows. And I saw this there and I came really close to buying it, but I knew I didn't have time to sit down and watch this documentary. Mm-hmm. But this is 2 weeks in a row now where the quote unquote oddity of having a real director do something for a band has popped up.
No kidding. And I think it'll end. I think the streak will end with this one, but we'll see. We'll see.
Well, and we do have like Spice Girls on the list.
Well, they had a movie. Do they have a real director that directed one of their videos? I don't know. Or a documentary about the band. And this isn't, obviously we talked about singles earlier in the show, but that was also directed by Cameron Crowe. So he was kind of revisiting the band 15 years later or whatever it turned out to be. Yeah.
And I still, if anything can be taken from this, I think watching Hype would give you a really strong view of what things were actually like in this period of time. Because, I mean, we're now where, I know I made a joke about the 80s being a period piece, but, you know, we're in the 90s as a period piece now. So,
oh, for sure.
I mean, when you see people walking around in torn up jeans and flannel shirts,
it's how quaint, how retro.
Yeah, how retro of you, yes.
Oh, I don't want to be that old, Hammond.
I don't either, but it's there. Real quick, they had a fan tragedy at the Roskilde tragedy, where nine fans were killed because they were crushed in the crowd. And they had to, I mean, that really affected them as a band, and they tried to stop, but by the time they realized what was going on, it was too late. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think this happens from time to time in concert settings. I know that it happened more frequently in the 70s, but, you know, the fact that it still happens now makes concerts, especially that area near the pit and up close, makes you think about going up there, and no matter how much you enjoy them, you can still hear them just as well from the back row.
Yeah, it's too bad. I mean, it's such a, it's so tragic. And again, yeah, like you said, it's something you think is predates having security people in the front and kind of preventing stuff like that from happening. But I guess not, which is, it's too bad.
And one more piece of shocking information that I found is that they actually testified in Congress about the whole Ticketmaster thing.
Oh, really?
So when you think about congressional hearings, you think about a certain look of person. And then you start wandering down the road of like the PMRC days in the early 90s with Twisted Sister showing up, you know, and sitting next to John Denver complaining about censorship in music. And then you have this image of Eddie Vedder and Pearl Jam sitting in a congressional hearing talking about, you know, price fixing and hikes mm-hmm. and stuff like that and overcharging people. And it changes your view of them as a band, and it changes the view of what Congress takes seriously on occasion.
Wow. Interesting. Yeah, I know about no idea about that.
Yeah. The only reason I found out is I went down a very dark rabbit hole about Ticketmaster while I was doing research.
Is any of that, like, is it available to watch? I'm sure, like, I'm
sure C-SPAN's got it somewhere. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it's somewhere, but I didn't go that far. I just was reading and trying to figure out if it had an effect, and I just couldn't find out if it actually made any difference. That's the sad part, I think.
Interesting.
Wow. So shall we move into our picks?
Let's move into our playlist. Yeah. And do you want me to go first or you want to go first?
No, you go ahead.
All right. So you're going to notice a very, I don't know about a common theme throughout my songs, but I picked songs that obviously always pick songs that I enjoy, and this doesn't veer from that, but it's also, these are kind of the more mellow ones that kind of showcase the songwriting, the lyric writing, that I think is one of my favorite things about Eddie Vedder, is that his lyrics are very poignant, and when you've got a song that kind of showcases that, then it's really, really compelling to me. Very interesting. So the first one is Just Breathe.
I'm a lucky man to count on both hands the ones I love. Some folks just have one, yeah, others they got none. Stay with me.
This one's from Backspacer, and it's like a, you know, it's the ending credits kind of song. It's like a very introspective, I'm trying to think of some of the lyrics, but it's just a really, really solid, solid song. And what's really interesting, or what's really cool, is that I've played a version of this on Coverville. Willie Nelson did a cover of this for his Heroes album back in 2012.
That would be cool. That idea really does. I mean,
that translated into to Willie Nelson's style.
And I think that's one of the things that draws me to Pearl Jam and Eddie Vedder with their lyrics and with their music, is the fact that I think that in the original form, it's very good. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to argue that, but I'm looking forward to seeing a generation of people interpret it and spit it back out. Mm-hmm. And I think we're starting to get to a point where that'll happen, but that's something I'm really looking forward to.
Right. But, all right. Next up in my list is Wishlist from Yield.
The Christmas tree. I wish I was.
This one, I think, is also on their greatest hits, but I couldn't not include it because it's, again, it's such a great song. It basically is a wish list. I mean, it's Eddie Vedder singing about, I wish I was this, or I wish I was this. And the, I can't think of the exact line, but it's like, I wish I was the sunlight reflecting off a hood of a Camaro's hood.
It's his version of a few of my favorite things, going back to kind of Sound of Music.
Yeah, it totally is. Holy cow. We've come full circle in the Eddie Vedder Sound of Music repertoire. But it is. I mean, it's basically it's like Eddie Vedder listing off his favorite things, or things that, you know, dreams and wishes and stuff like that. It's beautiful. I couldn't do a list like this without including a cover, and they've done more than a fair share. But this one is the one that actually became a hit for him, that was such a big hit for him that people maybe didn't realize that it's a cover. Eddie Cochran did the original version of the song Last Kiss. teen death songs, which were popular in the 60s, along with stuff like Dead Man's Curve and Teen Angel and stuff like this, where basically kids are killed by errant
fast cars and bad decisions.
Fast cars and trains. And yeah, exactly.
Those songs told the story of the Freddy Krueger of the 60s, where if you were doing something wrong, you were going to end up dying.
Yes, it was the final destination of,
of 60s musical.
Exactly. But it's a great translation, and it's some great Eddie Vedder vocals. Future Days, which comes from Lightning Bolt, another really nice acoustic piece.
Stolen missing parts, I've no need for any more. I believe, and I believe, 'cause I can see.
And is I don't know, kind of wistful about his people he's lost, friends and other people, other colleagues in the industry and stuff that he's lost. It's a really, really touching song. And then the last of my five is Glorify G from their second album, from Verses. I did have to throw something that was a little heavier in there, and this is it's a really, really good song.
Yeah, that was one I actually debated on.
Oh, really?
But I pulled it out because I was trying so hard to focus on post-94
Vitalogy. Yeah. Right. Yeah, makes sense. Well, then I couldn't stop at five. I had to have two more in here. Black is another one of those songs that, again, I rediscover through covers.
Now,
it's one that came out on 10, so it's one of their hits, and it's one that probably everybody's familiar with. But look for covers of that song, because it's a cool song. It's got all the building blocks for other artists and bands to make something completely fresh from. And that's a sign of a really, really good song. And then the end of my list of seven, because I cheated, is The End, also from Beck Spacer.
Changes does everything I wanted to grow. I just want to grow. Slide on next to me. I'm just a human being. I will take the
another really, really cool mellower song with some great lyric work from Eddie Vedder.
Well, don't think I won't learn from this. If you really like something, you can pick seven. Because yeah. I'm sure at some point I'll do that.
Cool. And now that I've broken the rules, rules can be broken many times in the future. I see how it is.
Precedent has been set, Your
right,
Honor.
Exactly. Let me take you back to the case of Ibbett versus Vedder of 2016.
I like your list. I appreciate your list as a fan of music. I steered more toward the heavier stuff.
Sure. This is good. I like that.
And I'll throw out that I really struggled with this one. This was an assignment that I had to kind of work at. because
once you got past the first three albums,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. Once I got past the first three albums, I really kind of had to work, and it was hard for me to find things that I liked on the subsequent albums. And I don't know if it was just my mindset or if there really was a case of samey sameys coming out as the albums got further along. And the lyrics are all good. I'm not knocking his songwriting skill as a songwriter. It's the musical challenge. Like I said, I think they challenge each other as recording, but as far as pushing the boundaries of their own musical talent or whatever, I really didn't see anything earth shattering from album to album. I didn't see any steps or evolution too much.
Well, it's funny you say that, because that's kind of an internal debate I have with myself a lot. Is it better for a band to have their sound evolve? Look at U2, look at the Beatles. I mean, a great example of their sound evolving over time.
Well, even Duran Duran last week, they had Duran Duran,
another great, yes, for sure. Or is it also good or as good for a band to be consistent? A Violent Femmes album, you know, from the sound of any track from any album. Morphine has that same kind of
typo negative. Ministry.
Typo negative. Yeah. See, there's so many bands like that where you can say, oh yeah, I know exactly AC/DC, who that is. I've never heard this
White
song
Zombie.
Before. Right. So there you go. I mean, you're hoping for, so I mean, is it better for a band to have that consistency over time, or is it better for them to evolve? And I guess it really just depends on the band and where that evolution takes them, if it is to some interesting and new places, or if it's better just like, oh no, you better dance with what brung you, basically.
Yeah, well, the other point though is it seemed as if they turned into kind of a campfire protest band the older they got.
Sure.
All that piss and vinegar of their youth seemed to disappear, and it just seems to become harder and harder to find moments of that as they've matured. And I guess that's what happens when you mature. But at the same time, I like the younger, angrier, kind of more driving version of Pearl Jam.
Sure.
And so I have a through line too, and I went through and picked five songs that kind of all remind me of the early version of Pearl Jam. And the first one I picked was Breakup Song. Binaural. And it's a song that when I listen to it, I'm reminded of what Pearl Jam was. And it's a straight ahead song, and there's not a lot of twists and turns in it. It's just a flash of what later Pearl Jam became as far as a hard rocking song. My second one is Marker and Sing. Actually has some really good lyrics, but it's also one of those kind of heavier songs, and it's off Pearl Jam, their self-titled album. And when I first heard it, the first few notes, I was hooked. I was in on it right off the bat. Then Insignificance was off Binaural again. All in all, it's no one's fault. Excuses time. And as I listened to the catalog of the later years, Binaural was definitely the one that stood out for me as with the most songs on it that I liked.
Sure. Yeah, it's interesting because Backspacer was that for me. So it's interesting that the two different directions there.
Yeah, and it was definitely the one that felt most experimental, but it was also the one where I felt like they were taking the most risks, both musically and lyrically. So, and then I chose Red Mosquito from No Code. I found it just to be, again, just a straight up traditional, well done Pearl Jam song. I mean, post 94 Pearl Jam, this is what their hard rock edge sounds like. And it's, I think if we interweave our every other song between our list, you'd probably get a really nice vibe.
I think so. I think you'd get a really good album.
Yeah.
12 songs.
And then I had to throw in Once from 10 because I absolutely love that song. That's one of those ones that when I hear it come on anywhere, I stop and listen to it. I got a bomb in my temple that is going to explode. I got a 16 gauge buried under my clothes. I play. I'm almost commanded to pay attention to that one. Mm-hmm. I have very vivid memories of the first time I heard it. I was in Nebraska and, you know, I was living in a basement and it was on a tape. And I vividly remember all about that. And so it holds a special place for me. So those are my five. And I need to throw out a big thank you to Corey and Carolyn for helping me because I was really struggling with post 94 and they kind of helped me get through. So they're my brother and sister-in-law and I really appreciate them for helping me out. So
cool.
big ups to them for helping.
Sometimes you need that, right? Sometimes you need that expert on the inside to be able to say, all right, here's where you want to go. Here are the pit stops you want to make on the road trip.
Yeah. And like I said, I listened and I was trying, and I think that you're probably going to end up with the bands that struggle to get through. And I'm going to,
totally.
I mean, that's kind of the challenge of this experiment we're doing is to learn about things, but also, I mean, if we're going to have opinions, we better plow through the snow to get there.
Totally true. Very cool. Well, I like that. I like that list a lot. I'm going to go listen to your five actually when we're done recording this, cause I want to hear that rockin' set.
Okay.
Excellent. Well, that is going to bring us to the end of another episode of Soundography. Hope you guys enjoyed that as much as we did.
We're going to tease out next week's.
I was wondering, should we? Yeah, let's do it. Yeah. All right. Next week, we are going to be tackling Blues Traveler, John Popper and Blues Traveler, and it's going to be impossible for me not to bring up the movie Kingpin, so you better watch that between now and then.
Well, and it's going to be, I mean, there's almost two flavors of Blues Traveler. There's the live flavor of Blues Traveler, and there's the studio flavor of Blues Traveler.
Yes.
And no one can cover all of it. It's going it's an insurmountable mountain of music.
For sure. So stick around for next week. Blues Traveler will be the band we tackle. And of course, if you want to get in touch with us, email us soundographypodcast@gmail.com is where you can find us. You can visit us on Twitter, follow us, like us, retweet us, all that stuff at The Soundography. And of course, visit soundography.com, our homepage, where you can find all this great stuff, previous shows, and maybe even an idea of what's coming up. Thanks again for joining us. For Hammond Chamberlain, this is Brian Abbott saying thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time here on Soundography.